Recently, Colin has been going through a series titled Judgment and Justice. And last time he mentioned how the Israelites had this mentality of getting justice for any slight against them. We have heard this termed the eye for an eye principle. Indeed, in the Old Covenant is laid out in great detail what specific retaliations could be exacted for which offenses. These retaliations were often viewed as wins or losses. And just recently, I heard this philosophy echoed again in the news around the present war in the Middle East. There's an hilarious book available entitled A Year of Living Biblically by A.A. Jacobs. In it, he details his year-long attempt to live by every doctrine, ritual, commandment, edict, or local law set out in the Old Covenant. Needless to say, he did not succeed. Some of the principles which bound the ancient Israelites would be punishable by death in this day and age. But in today's sermon, I'd like to hone in on one of what might be termed the greatest wins for ancient Israel, and more specifically, the Jewish people. Just about 2 weeks ago, on March 2nd and 3rd, Jews around the world celebrated the Feast of Purim. Our look at the Bible today will focus on the why, how, and what laid the foundations for this Jewish celebration. This is not one of the celebrations that we observe during our Judeo-Christian phase. Herbert Armstrong described our religion as Judeo-Christian, and emphasis was placed on the culture, rituals, holy days, and celebrations of ancient Israel. Why then did we not embrace Purim? Back in the day, did you have any idea what the Feast of Purim was and what it commemorated? I must say I never did pay too much attention to it. But my understanding was that it was a day of ritual washings. That was totally wrong. It has nothing at all to do with washing. But it was a time of joyous, boisterous celebration with lots of food, gift-giving, and even encouragement to strong drink. There was even a special golden individual drinking vessel, which in Judaism today is called a ritan, and it's carried from place to place during the feasting. Before we go any further, let's go back to the beginning of this feast and get some background as to how it came about. We need to journey all the way back to one of the greatest empires on earth, around 486 to 465 before the Common Era. The Persian king Xerxes, as he is known in Greek, or Ahasuerus in Hebrew, was reigning over 127 provinces, stretching across most of the known world from India to Kush, or Lower Egypt, Ethiopia. The time period we're looking at is between the return of the Jewish exiles and the start of rebuilding Jerusalem to the beginning of New Covenant times. So approximately 2400 to 2500 years ago. Just something to keep at the back of your mind. Where is Persia today? Yeah, it's Iran. That custom of carrying a golden drinking vessel may have come from the practice of Persian soldiers who carried their individual drinking cups on their belts so they could celebrate their victories wherever they occurred. We come to the Persian capital city of Susa. And this is where we find a group of exiled Jews who did not return home to the land of Israel after the captivity was ended. Among them is the man Mordecai of the tribe of Benjamin and his niece Esther, whom he had taken to raise as his daughter after the death of her parents. Here we could read the book of Esther, but we would have to do just that, read the complete book. It takes approximately an hour to read all 10 chapters. Or we could do a recap of the story. Chapter 1. King Xerxes had spent 6 months showing off all his wealth to his headmen from the 127 provinces and the neighboring countries. His final piece of property to display was his queen, Vashti. When he called for her to be brought into the showroom wearing her best clothes and the royal crown, she refused. This threw the royal court into chaos. After consultation with his advisors, Xerxes issued a proclamation that Vashti was never to enter the presence of the king again. She would be replaced by someone better than she. Then he sent handwritten dispatches to all the parts of the kingdom to declare that every man should be the ruler over his own household. Chapter 2. So began the search for Vashti's replacement. Beautiful young virgins were to be brought from all corners of the kingdom and put through a year-long beauty treatment. 6 months of oil of myrrh and another 6 months with perfume and cosmetics. After which she would be presented to the king. Among them was this Jewish girl, Esther. When it came her time to go before the king, she won the favor of everyone who saw her, and the king was attracted to her more than to any other woman. During this time, Mordecai had heard two officers planning to assassinate the king. He told Esther what he had heard, and she passed it on to the king, and credit was given to Mordecai. It was proven to be true, and both officers were hanged. All this was written in the annals of the king. Chapter 3. The king wanted to honor one of his nobles, Haman. So he exalted him above all the other officials, and they bowed down to him whenever he passed by. Mordecai refused to bow down and told the officials it was because he was a Jew. Haman was incensed and decided to destroy all the Jewish people throughout all 127 provinces. Haman asked the king for permission to destroy the Jews, and the king gave him his signet ring and said, "Do whatever you want to these people." So Haman and his men cast the pur, the dice or the lot, to determine when the massacre would occur. The king issued an order to annihilate all the Jews in the whole kingdom. If you are aware of what goes on in a Jewish synagogue, you will know that the book of Esther is read in the morning and again in the evening of the Feast of Purim. Congregants are given noisemakers called groggers, which, along with the booing of the children, are used to drown out every mention of the nefarious Haman's name. There is booing, stomping of feet, and the cacophonous noise of the groggers. Chapter 4. When Mordecai heard the order read in the capital city of Susa, he fasted at the city gates in sackcloth and ashes. In all the provinces, there was mourning, fasting, and weeping among the Jewish people. Esther was aware that she couldn't just go into the king's presence without being called. So she told Mordecai to gather all the Jews in Susa and fast for her for 3 days and nights, and then she would try to petition the king for their lives. Chapter 5. After 3 days and three nights, Esther dressed in her royal robes and stood in the courtyard. The king saw her and held out the gold scepter to give her permission to come into his presence. He asked her what her request was and said that he would give her whatever she asked, up to half of the kingdom. Her answer was to invite the king and Haman to a banquet that she would prepare. When the king asked again during the banquet what her petition was, she invited the king and Haman to a second banquet the next day, where she would make her request known. Meanwhile, Haman had seen Mordecai at the gate again, refusing to bow down. So he built a gallows 75 feet high on which to have Mordecai hanged. Chapter 6. During that night, the king couldn't sleep, so he ordered the record of his reign to be brought for him to read. As he read through, he discovered that Mordecai had saved him from an assassination attempt, but had never been rewarded. When the king heard that Haman was in the courtyard, he said, "Bring him in." And the king asked Haman what he thought should be given to the man in whom the king delights. Now Haman thought the king was speaking about him. So he asked for a royal robe that the king had worn, and a royal horse with the king's crest, and that he should ride through the streets of the city to the adulation of the people. So the king said, "Go and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai the Jew who sits at the king's gate." Haman was mortified, and he went home to tell his family what had happened. His wife said, "Mordecai is of Jewish origin. You cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin." That's when the king's servants came to take Haman to the second banquet hosted by Queen Esther. Chapter 7. During the banquet, the king again asked Esther what her petition was. Up to this point, it would seem the king did not know that Esther was a Jewess. She asked for the deliverance of her people from the death sentence settled on them by Haman. Haman had come into the room where Esther was to ask for mercy, but the king, already enraged at Haman's treachery, saw it as harassment and ordered Haman to be taken out and hanged on the gallows he had prepared for Mordecai. That's the epitome of coming back to bite. Chapter 8. All of Haman's estate was given to Queen Esther. Then Esther introduced Mordecai as her relative. The order was still in effect to kill all the Jews in the kingdom. So Esther petitioned the king to reverse that order. But the law was that any previous order of the king was irrevocable. So the king asked Mordecai to write a new decree. Mordecai wrote the new order and sealed it with the king's signet ring, giving Jews the freedom of the kingdom and the right of assembly. They were also given the authority to destroy the armies of any nation who desired to attack and plunder the Jews. The new order went out, and there was great happiness, feasting, and celebrations among Jews in all the provinces. Chapter 9. Came the day when the edict to kill all the Jews would come into force, and all those who wanted to destroy the Jews were seized with the fear of Mordecai. Nobody stood against the Jews because all the other nationalities were afraid of them. They knew Mordecai was a prominent figure in the king's court and very powerful. So instead of the Jews being slaughtered, 500 men were killed and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged that day in the citadel of Susa. Again, the king asked Esther what her petition was, and she asked permission to extend the killings to a second day. So the Jews put 300 more men to death. Meanwhile, in the provinces, they killed 75,000 people. During all these killings, The Jews did not take any plunder. After the 2 days of killing, Mordecai wrote to the Jews instructing them to observe a day of joy, fasting, celebration, and giving presents of food to the poor. They called the feast Purim, because Haman had cast Pur, the lot. So Queen Esther sent letters to all 127 provinces to establish the Feast of Purim to be observed throughout all their generations. This directive from Queen Esther was entered into the records of King Xerxes. Chapter 10. Mordecai's greatness was proclaimed throughout Media and Persia. Mordecai was second in power only to King Xerxes because he worked for the good of his people and spoke for the welfare of all Jews. So we see here that Queen Esther authored two decrees, one to save the Jews from annihilation, and two to establish the Feast of Purim, which was entered into the Hebrew calendar around 460 before the Common Era. The name of God is not mentioned once anywhere in the Book of Esther. It is the only book in the canon that does not mention God. However, God's hand is clearly seen in every aspect of the Jewish deliverance. Not all Jewish feast celebrations or holy days are established by God. There are three different categories of festivals and holy days. There are six biblical or rabbinical holy days or festivals, four Israeli Jewish national holidays, and at least two days of remembrance. Esther was able to establish the Feast of Purim because it was to be observed and celebrated throughout all their generations, a day, or in some cases 2 days, of remembrance of the Jewish deliverance from the wrath of Haman. Another thing to keep in mind is that God's promise through Abraham to the Israelites, and more specifically to the tribe of Judah, is unconditional. In God's first promise to Abram, in Genesis 12, verses 2 and 3, we read, "I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you." And the second blessing, where his name was changed to Abraham, in Genesis 17, starts in verse 5, but we'll pick it up in verses 6 to 11, where we find a blessing sealed with the covenant of circumcision. "I will make you very fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings will come from you. I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for the generations to come, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you. The whole land of Canaan, where you are now an alien, I will give as an everlasting possession to you and your descendants after you, and I will be their God." The word translated as "will" in these verses is the Hebrew word yashav, which means to sit or to dwell. But in this context, it infers permanence and intention. It was an unconditional promise because God does not do anything without intent. Something that is promised is as good as received. Carrying on in verse 9. "Then God said to Abraham, 'As for you, you must keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you for the generations to come. This is my covenant with you and your descendants after you, the covenant you are to keep. Every male among you shall be circumcised.'" Now we also know that not all Jews are Israelites. Not all Israelites are Jews. We cannot look at a certain group or an individual and say they are the chosen people of that promise. Throughout history, there have been captivities of the Jewish people, which have led to the diaspora or dispersion of Jewish people outside the land of Israel into all areas of the globe. We are familiar with the Old Covenant Assyrian captivity and the Babylonian captivity. And in 539 before the Common Era, Babylon fell to the Persian King Cyrus. And Jews who had been dispersed to Babylon and not returned home found themselves under Persian rule. The same King Cyrus, who was also known as Cyrus the Great and the first Shah of Persia or Iran, was Queen Esther's grandson. The covenant with Abraham has never been questioned when it comes to the chosen people. They have laid claim to the promise throughout history. And we have in the Old Covenant account after account of how they have been delivered in their times of trouble. Most often, as in the story of Esther, the means by which they would have been slaughtered has been turned back on their enemies and used as the tools of their deliverance. King David in Psalm 35 had no qualms whatsoever in asking God to fulfill that promise when he was being opposed. In verses 1 to 3, "Contend, O Lord, with those who contend with me. Fight against those who fight against me. Take up shield and buckler. Arise and come to my aid. Brandish sword and javelin against those who pursue me. Say to my soul, I am your salvation." In 2 Samuel 7, 22 to 25, when David had been told that he was to become the head of the chosen nation, Israel, he gives prayers of thanks. "How great you are, O sovereign Lord! There is no one like you, and there is no God but you, as we have heard with our own ears. And who is like your people Israel, the one nation on earth, that God went out to redeem as a people for himself and to make a name for himself and to perform great and awesome wonders by driving out nations and their gods from before your people, whom you redeemed from Egypt. You have established your people Israel as your very own forever, and you, O Lord, have become their God." Verse 25, "And now, Lord God, keep forever the promise you have made concerning your servant and his house. Do as you promised." Even though this is a prayer for the house of David, it applies equally to all the descendants of Abraham, of which we are his spiritual descendants, according to the teaching of Jesus passed on by the Apostle Paul, Galatians 3:29. "If you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise." We have been given the authority to claim God's promise to Abraham, just as David did. We may not expect an eye for an eye, but we should have no fear of whatever may come our way. With God as our shield and Abraham as our father, who can stand against us? We have read and heard about the many times God has intervened for his people. Whatever our foes may mete out just may come back to bite us.